when did I realise I was a woman? I still don't realise that I'm a woman in that sense, being pedantic. I'm a trans woman and I'm very pleased and I'm proud to call myself a trans woman.
My name's Andrew Lee and welcome to The Good Life, a podcast about living a happy, healthy and ethical life. Although I'm a politician and an economist, this isn't a podcast about politics or economics. It's about living a good life, which is an idea that goes back to the Greek philosopher Aristotle. What Aristotle meant by a good life was the life that one would like to live, a life with pleasure, meaning, and richness of spirit. The life that most of us were trying to live until everything else got in the way. In this podcast, I'll seek out guests not because they're smart, but because they're wise. I'll speak with writers, athletes, and social justice campaigners, with people who've been lucky and those who've experienced hard times. I've found their stories fascinating, and I hope you do too. Kate McGregor was born in 1956, one of four children in a very Catholic family in Toowoomba. She went to Duntroon and played rugby, where she met Tony Abbott and became fast friends. In 1974, she joined the army and rose to the rank of captain. Leaving the army in 1980s, worked in politics for Bob Carr, then for John Hewson on the other side of politics, and then in journalism. In 2000, she returned to the army to help with the effort in East Timor and switched to the RAF in 2014. Kate is the author of An Indian Summer of Cricket and a keen cricket player herself. She was the 2016 Queenslander of the Year. But it's also an interesting fact that Kate was born Malcolm and only made a gender reassignment in recent years. Kate, welcome to the Good Life podcast.
Hi, Andrew, and thanks for inviting me.
Tell me about the reassignment. What made you make the decision, and how long had you felt that perhaps you were a woman?
Well, I guess I need to be careful about the language. I have always felt that I was trans, in that I felt conflict about my gender. I was drawn to transitioning to womanhood and functioning as a woman. Did I feel I was a woman? I'm not sure that I ever did. That sounds paradoxical, but I don't claim womanhood. I've spoken on the public record a bit, and I always describe myself as a trans woman. I cannot replicate the social conditioning that born women have, especially when you transition as late as I did. But I had strong cross-gender identification from a very young age. I wanted to live as a woman from my teens. I cross-dressed when I was very young, 8, 9, that kind of time. And ultimately, the pain and incongruence or lack of congruity became overwhelming, and I got to 2011 and the summer of 2011-12, I couldn't go another day. I actually thought I'd kind of avoided it. I'd had these identifications and feelings. I'd sought treatment on and off over my life, but I had a feeling that maybe they'd resolved. And in fact, I spoke to a couple of friends and said, you know, I nearly gender transitioned in the 80s, and that would have been a terrible mistake. I now look back and realise that the depth of my own denial, my self-deception, and the fact that my conditioning was such that it wasn't a realistic option for me. I felt that it was disgraceful, that I was abandoning everything I'd ever been brought up to believe in, and that it wasn't viable for me. The first day after I let go that burden, I realised I'd been wrong all along. And so when did I realise I was a woman? I still don't realise that I'm a woman in that sense, being pedantic. Mm. I'm a trans woman and I'm very pleased and I'm proud to call myself a trans woman. The feelings were there for as long as I can recall is the short answer to your question.
You've talked in the past about living a kind of crazy brave life, one in which you took a lot of risks, were willing to get into bar fights with people bigger than you, drank a fair bit. Mm. Do you see that as potentially providing some signals? You've talked also about Kristen Beck, who was part of the Bin Laden raid, who transitioned.
Yeah.
Possibly that some of those who make the transition are living as crazy brave
men before they make the transition
to
trans women?
Look, there's no template that fits every trans woman, but I knew a lot of the showgirls when I was on the fringe of the scene, and I experienced their company, and I checked. I went and sought advice from Carlotta and others, and it was that confirmation bias. I was running around pleading with these girls to tell me I wasn't transgendered, and all of them just looked at me and said, "You are, darling. It's what you're describing is transsexualism." There's a psychiatrist and researcher called Anne Vitale, who happens to be trans, who has written some very good scholarly work through Stanford, and this actually clinched it for me. When I was groping around looking for answers again at the end of 2011, I started Google searching stuff, and I found her work. She described me to a T, because I had a template or a stereotype of a trans woman that was an effeminate showgirl, very beautiful, often had been a very sissy boy, had been at school, bullied out of school, frail, not into boy things, and strong female identification from being about four or five, often left the school system due to bullying and transitioned. And many of them ended up on the fringe of the sex industry, or the really, really pretty ones ended up stripping or ended up in shows. I thought, my life's not like that. I'm a semi-professional sports person. I'm pretty academically gifted. I've been a soldier. And I think what I did was I overcompensated. I sought out ways of affirming my masculinity in really overt ways, and I really manned up. And with the getting of wisdom, Andrew, and we talked just before we started about age and wisdom and going from intellect to say emotional intelligence. Mm. With hindsight, I suspect a large part of the life that I chose was a sublimated suicide urge. I think deep down, I was putting myself in precarious situations because at some deep part of me, I didn't care whether I lived or died. That's what I think was going on.
Did you feel happy at that moment where you were pushing the envelope?
Look, I had moments of achievement in my life. I remember topping my class at Duntroon 3 years. I played some exceptional sport. The triumph of sport, the feeling of belonging to teams. I had moments of elation when I succeeded at things. I loved my wife. I have never been happier than the day I was married. Having said all that, there was an underlying element of irritability and discontent in me. And people who know me, you'll hear pretty mixed reports about me, and they're valid. I have been a volatile character. I've disappointed a lot of people. I think I earned a reputation for being unreliable, for being mercurial. I've betrayed people. I've let people down. None of it was my best self, and quite a lot of it, I think, was really unconscious behaviour. I think I had an explosive temper. I had a very low attention span. A lot of this I now trace back to my gender dysphoria. I think that there was a lack of stillness at my core, a lack of comfort in my own skin, and I looked outside myself for answers, and I lashed out at people who offended me. I was insecure. I was a bundle of insecurities. So when I look back with some depth perception now from the age of 60, I can see that probably the most significant thing about my life was my gender, that all along I was improvising solutions. I was hyping up my masculinity. I was desperately trying to answer questions to myself, and I was trying to prove to others that I was a real man. And there was this sort of hyper-driven overachieving thing, somehow trying to prove that life was okay for me. I can see that with hindsight. I now think I would have made an admirable woman at age 25 and probably done much less conspicuously successful, externally successful work, but been calmer inside myself. But that wasn't my path, and there's no point looking back with regret.
Choosing that or achieving that stillness must have been an extraordinary sense of personal satisfaction.
Yeah.
But for you also to have it come at the cost of your marriage of 15 years, in some sense just speaks to how strongly you must have wanted this transition.
Yeah, that broke my heart. It broke my heart. And you can't have everything. And it really was... I never saw the film Sophie's Choice, but it's invoked as the term between...
I was nearly going
to
say.
Yeah, slaughtering something you deeply adore to say... I callously, in one sense, chose to save myself. And my wife... I looked into my wife's eyes and told her what was disturbing me. She knew something was wrong. I was anxious. I was sleepless. She knew that I was depressed. She had inferred that perhaps I was grappling with childhood sexual abuse or something of that nature. And she was watching vigilantly. My anxiety was contagious. We were both lying awake in our bed at night, holding one another like two people marooned in a nightmare. And when I told her, I saw her face change and it devastated her. I've never been able to completely forgive myself for that betrayal, in that I had disquiet about my gender. But look, in good conscience, Andrew, I would never have married her had I thought the day would come when I would have to deal with this again. At the time I met her and married her, I was in probably what would be referred to as remission. I vaguely used to have thoughts about my gender, but I did not enter that marriage with anything other than a clear conscience that I would spend the rest of my life with her. We're still very, very close. I've not spoken publicly on the record about this, but I'm undergoing my final surgery on Wednesday. I go to Melbourne. She's going to be there. She'll be the last person I see before I go to sleep. And all things being equal, she'll be the first person I see when I wake up. We love one another deeply. She is a person of extraordinary compassion and depth. I adore her and she loves me deeply. But yes, that was the hardest part. I was willing to live with the vilification, the loss of opportunity, all kinds of things, but the one irreplaceable loss has been that marriage. And there isn't a day that has passed that I haven't felt sad about my marriage.
Well, my best wishes for Wednesday.
Thank you.
And it's wonderful to hear that that your former wife will be there with you at such a difficult moment.
It speaks much more of her than it does of me, frankly, in that she's one person that I've seen who has transcended great personal loss, betrayal, and deep hurt to come out the other side a radiant, loving person who can integrate this experience into her life without rancor. I can't imagine what grandeur of spirit that requires. I envy her. I'm a person who still has a hair trigger. I still nurse slights far too often. Maybe it's one of the reasons I was drawn to the New South Wales right of the Labor Party. What's the old motto? In victory, revenge, and in defeat, rancor. But I have noticed, since I've transitioned genders, by the way, and achieved some level of comfort, I think I'm a less angry person. I've got into some spats on Twitter that I've regretted, I must say. I've been at my worst on social media and occasionally let myself down and been ashamed of that. But people who knew me well, and funnily enough, I sat next to one of your state counterparts, Prue Goward, at the Border Medal. Prue knew me quite well through David, her husband, David Barnett, and we used to do a show together when I was on the left, and we had some blazing rows on the precursor to Insiders, which was called The Last Shout. Mm. And Prue showed great insight. She said, "You're a much calmer, gentler person. There's an ease in you now, Catherine, that I never dreamt of." And she said, "You were quite an intimidating, scary fellow, you know." And I said, I couldn't imagine that, frankly. I never felt intimidatory or scary. But she said, the change is beyond physical. It's quite, there's a peace in you and a gentleness that I never thought I'd see. And it's quite remarkable. So I was very touched when she said that.
Is it a better life to live calmly than to live with the blazing trail of achievements?
Yeah.
Which is as you lived before?
I would swap every external achievement to have lived as a woman from the age of, say, 25. The only caveat I voiced, and I said this in my address to the National Press Club, had I not met Tricia, my life would have been the poorer. I have met my soulmate, and I'm deeply. That compensates in some way. The other thing is, the only other jingly or accolade I've got that really matters is my Order of Australia. I felt that I earned that. A lot of the trolls online say I got that as a PC giveaway because I'm transgendered. It's bollocks. I got that as a male. I was awarded that for my service before transition. I earned that on merits. And I'm deeply proud of it because I was relatively junior to receive that award. It's normally reserved for brigadiers and above, but my service was deemed exemplary enough for that exception to be made. I'm deeply proud of that. Would have liked to have got a first-class 100 at Lord's and haven't but I'll say yet. But really, it is funny. And I think, again, you've alluded, one of your themes in this is that the getting of wisdom and looking back with some level of reflection on life. And you realise in the end that interior things are vastly more important than external things. I'm now of an age where I meditate in the morning, and I meditate every day with great gratitude just for being healthy. You wake on a Canberra morning with a hint of autumn in the air today, the crispness and the cool, and frankly, I say a prayer of gratitude that I have my faculties, that I'm mobile, that the simplest pleasures of coffee and a good book and a walk in the sunlight are there. The day that you don't have that is when you realise it's gone and you miss that. And testamas on walls, or medals on the chest, or money in a bank account becomes terribly insignificant when those really fundamental simple pleasures are gone. And I do genuinely revel in them today. And as Catherine McGregor, a trans woman, comfortable in my own skin, I believe that I am now sensually alive in a way that I never have been before. And I deeply immerse myself in the stream of life. I do love being alive today. And maybe that's showing, I'm not sure.
It certainly is. One of the things you have to do, of course, when you make a transition is to choose a new name. Is it true that you chose Kate because it rhymes with mate?
No, that's bollocks. dear old Malcolm Farr got that completely wrong. What he did was morphed an email I sent him. I said that I'd chosen Catherine Elizabeth McGregor. Elizabeth was my mother's middle name, and I wanted to pay that homage to Mum, who never lived to see me arrive as myself. Catherine was the name of a woman with whom I was in love a long time ago. I told her I was transgendered, and she accepted it. It was really interesting. There's a funny story attached to it, in fact. I adored her. She was a beautiful woman. I won't break her anonymity. She was a Canberra girl. She's now living in London. Lovely woman. And in a moment of spontaneous honesty, I told her that I had misgivings about my gender, and she was completely unfazed by it. So in a funny way, I paid homage to her. We've since got in touch, and I'm going to see her in London in May when I go over to play cricket. I misspelled her name. She used to call herself she called herself Jane in that era, but used her full name later on. And it turns out she's a K-A-T-H-R-Y-N. So I chose Catherine. And what I told Malcolm Farr is I said, I've chosen the name Catherine, but in the best Australian military traditions, it's been abbreviated to Kate, which rhymes with mate. And given the scatological propositions that are possible in an Australian Army nickname environment, I was cutting my losses while I was in front, as it were. So that's completely wrong. That's just not quite right. I chose it for really quite sentimental reasons. And again, I think you're the first person I've ever told that to in public.
Well, I'm glad to have the record corrected. What's been the greatest surprise about becoming a transgender woman?
Right. Look, lots of them. On balance, Andrew, my experience has been benign. I've had pockets of quite appalling abuse, and it's been disappointing. And as I said, I'm not proud of my response to that. I wish I had shown greater grace, because whether I like it or not, I'm kind of the most high-profile transgendered woman in the country. And people judge trans by my conduct, and on occasions I've failed. But what really has surprised me is actually how generous most people are. Apart from some really fundamentalist Christians who have behaved appallingly, apart from a few very insecure blokes, atheist blokes who don't have any religious objection to this, but I seem to hit their buttons, and they get arced up about it. But they're a telephone booth minority compared to the vast majority of average folks who frankly don't give a toss about my gender. And it's the unearned act of kindness that you get occasionally when people know you're trans and they accept you, and the first time when you're not necessarily looking particularly womanly that someone calls you ma'am in a shop, or a cab driver calls you love and gives you your change and wishes you well. Those little interactions, what you'd call from the Social Democrat tradition, I guess, social capital, those little unprompted webs, spider webs of grace that run through our community that make us a society. I've been an overwhelming beneficiary of those. So on balance, that's been the biggest surprise. The other one, and I always tell female audiences in this and it gets into splits, is the amount of time it takes me to get out the door now. When I was an army officer with a buzz cut, all I had to do was run a razor over my face and I was gone. I take ages to get out the door now. The faffing around, the depilation, the amount of stuff that goes into getting this show on the road every day is time that could well be spent thinking big thoughts. But the cost of doing business, and I quite enjoy it, frankly. It's a new experience. And having transitioned late, exploring, you know, just how I look and what fashion works for me and stuff is kind of an adventure, and I let myself try to enjoy that.
So you make it sound like, in general, Australians have been more accepting about your gender transition now than they were about your transition from a Labor staffer to a Liberal staffer in the early 1990s. Would that be true?
Look, it's about right. Look, you know, look, I still love the Labor Party, by the way. It's a source of some grief. Two losses. I've spoken about my marriage. By transitioning genders, I lost the comfort of religion. I'm not excommunicated formally from the Catholic Church, but I'm not in communion with Rome. I believe, and I still believe, I pray, and I drew great comfort from its rituals. I have a great sentimental attachment to the Labour movement. I find it intellectually fascinating. Bill Hayden said it's a party with an historic mission. I still think that's true. I've drifted to the conservative side of politics, partially due to feuds and animosities more than ideology. You know how rancid our culture wars are. You get lumped in a team and you kind of end up staying there. Sometimes it's, well, I'll stick here because this is where my tribe is. But I got a fair old bollocking from people when I changed sides. Again, I look back on that. That wasn't an ideological decision. I had a falling out with certain elements of the New South Wales right. I wasn't long off alcohol. I went to Alcoholics Anonymous and quit drinking in 1989. I went and saw Bob Carr, who'd been a real rock, and I said, Bob, I think I need out of this building because, as you know, parliaments have bars that, in that era, the bar would trade all night if we sat all night. I was a round-the-clock drinker. I was very sick, and I just said to him, I think I need to be in a totally new environment to get sober and stay sober, and my life's on the line. I went with his blessing, but I then had to find a way to make money, and I started lobbying for a living, and I regret doing that, to be honest. It's an odious profession, and I didn't get great satisfaction from it. And I lobbied for some clients who ended up having fights with Labor governments, and I campaigned for them, and by default drifted across the line to basically where I was welcome. Because, as you know, you don't get a yellow card from the New South Wales right. You're sent off and suspended for 10 matches rather than time in the sin bin. And it ended the relationship.
Right.
And
being it's more horse's heads than yellow cards.
It is a bit. And I took the grudge. With hindsight, I look back and think I was too emotionally volatile. I was not long off drugs and alcohol. I now know that in that period of time, you shouldn't make big life decisions because your wiring's pretty fried. And I allowed a couple of personal fallings out to take on epic significance. And I shouldn't have allowed, you know, a couple of feuds, one with Della Bosca and the other with Richardson, to determine the course of my later life. I actually had a mild reconciliation with the party when Kim was leader, Kim Beazley. We're still mates. And I wrote the odd speech for Kim. Swanee acted as a conduit into the party for me as well. I got on pretty well with Swanee, and I think I still do. And I did a little bit of work for Kim, but Breton and a number of others were absolutely adamant that I would never darken the door of the Labor movement again. And I put out a couple of overtures, and frankly, I didn't need to be told twice, so I just walked away in the end. And it became a decision by default. I've got pretty conservative views on some things, but in terms of, I don't believe in neoliberal economics. I believe in the right of Australians to join trade unions. I think people, especially people with low skills who are not in trade unions, are making a big mistake. I would welcome a clean, healthy, well-regulated trade union movement. I think it's vital to the living standards of ordinary Australians. So I'm not an easy fit on any side of politics, to be perfectly honest with you. I nakedly believe in redistributive economics as well. I think progressive taxation was a great social advance brought in by that well-known socialist Theodore Roosevelt. And so I hope I'm a more nuanced, complex person politically than a lot of people give me credit for. But we're in a nuance-free world now, and you know, as we tweet, so we are. And I write for News Limited, so I've got one horn growing out of one side of my head, and I've ratted on the Labor Party, so I've got another horn on the other side of the head, and a spiky tail to boot.
But you've written one of the most important progressive speeches of recent years, David Morrison's speech following the revelations of abuse within the armed forces, in which he said, "The standard you walk past is the standard you accept." Talk to me about speech writing, what it is to create a good speech, and the extent to which you need to be passionate about the issues you're writing about to write a good speech.
Yeah, look, good point. You've got to be passionate about what you write about. I think I'm blessed, Andrew, in that I've read a lot, and that was partially by default. My mum was a teacher. She loved literature, and we're talking now in a language that most of your listeners will just be aghast at. No iPads, no computers, no mobile phones. We had an old Bakelite dial-in phone. We used to dial through the exchange to make long-distance calls. I got quite sick in my first couple of years at school and wasn't homeschooled, but I missed a lot of school with pneumonia and hemorrhagic measles. I just started reading books randomly off the shelf at home. And if I hit a word I didn't understand, I'd ask Mum. If I hit a phrase, I had a precociously high reading age at quite a young age. And it started a love affair with language that has never ended. I adore great writing. You've just seen as we had a warm-up, I cry when beautiful prose can bring tears to my eyes the way music does. I love polyphony. The human voice makes me cry when I hear polyphony sung. So writing speeches, I think, is born of reading a lot, because nothing in this world is original. You know, if you've read Shakespeare, if you've read a lot of the great poets, if you've read some of the Greeks, some of the cadences and inversion. Shakespeare's great because he wrote in the lingua franca of his day. That was the spoken word. It was doggerel in some ways. But because of it now sounds ornate to us, but he does have some wonderful devices. Inversion of words in sentences. What say you? It sounds more... What do you think? It's, you know, what say you? It has a beautiful quality. So I revel in language. And that speech I wrote for Morrison, that got vastly overplayed, frankly. I think it was 3 minutes, 48 seconds. It was a political commercial on stilts. I've written vastly, vastly better speeches than that, intricately argued, with quotes from some of the greats and so on. I could bang on for ages. I love the spoken word, but... My favourite speech, and again, you're not a cricket person, but I commend to any of your listeners, pull up on YouTube a speech given by an Indian cricketer in Canberra, just up the road at the National War Memorial. Rahul Dravid gave a speech, the Bradman Oration in 2011, that Don Watson would cut off an arm to have written. It was beautifully cadenced, and he talked about the poorest country on earth and its love affair with cricket. And he made Bradman an Indian hero. He talked about Bradman being the avenging angel of Indians during the time that they were fighting for their independence. They couldn't beat England at anything, and they'd lie awake at night listening to Bradman punishing England on their home grounds. And the night that Jawaharlal Nehru was arrested by the colonial police, Bradman scored 254 at Lord's. And that juxtaposition made a huge impact on a young lad called K.N. Prabhu, who was the greatest post-independence cricket writer in India. It's a glorious speech. I sat there transfixed with Michael Cooney, who was Julia Gillard's speech writer of the day, and we both looked at one another and went, did he write that? And sure enough, he did. But I could bang on. I hope I've got some more writing in me. Keats wrote a beautiful... My favourite passage when I'm writing blocked is Keats's sonnet, "When I have fears that I may cease to be, before my pen hath gleaned my teeming brain, before high pilot books in rich charactery hold full garners like rich ripened grain." It's just gold. I can read that and go away and write for 2 hours.
Is that your preparation for writing? You tend to read some poetry first?
Now that I don't smoke, yes. When I first started writing, I'd have a packet of cigarettes to get the frontal lobe firing. I don't do that anymore. I'll often listen to Polyphony, as I said. I can listen to Clemens Non Papa or Monteverdi, and that will make my soul soar. But occasionally I will sit with beautiful prose. Henry V's Agincourt speech from Shakespeare. Mm. It's a glorious speech. Douglas MacArthur gave a great speech about the profession of arms that is so beautifully cadenced. There's a speech by the American patriot Patrick Henry. You'd know it for its famous line, "Give me liberty or give me death." He says in that, "Gentlemen may cry peace, peace, but there is no peace. The war has actually begun. The next gale that sweeps from the north shall bring to our ears the clash of resounding arms." Wouldn't you die to write that?
Ah, yes.
The clash of resounding arms. People don't write and speak like that anymore. By the way, and you're a working politician, I think we undersell our audience. I think people's hearts rise to great speeches. I don't think we're pragmatic. I think there's a romantic inside all those people. You know, there's this elite divide and the bogans, and people are saying that people who read the telly don't want to hear all this highfalutin stuff. I've seen average Australians weep at a beautiful speech. There's something primal in the spoken word and in storytelling. We're oral creatures.
Do you have a particular time of day in which you write?
It depends. No, I don't. I'm not disciplined. Gideon Haig's a great friend of mine. Gideon gets up and he bangs out his work and starts early. Other writers I admire, I think Flanagan's in this category as well. He allocates time and he gets on the tools and writes. I tend to write when the impulse overtakes me. I write for a tabloid, so I'm not Wordsworth. I write for the telly. So I write on deadline too. Like, nothing prompts me quite like the editor saying, "Where's your effing copy?" that generally gets me moving. Yep. But I tend to write in the morning. But if I get an impulse, I'll write late at night. And sometimes on the road with cricket, I'll scribble some notes down, if a few phrases. If I've heard something that really touches me, I'll capture it. Or I'll go and try and listen to it through the headset if I've heard something. Or you can often find a recitation of a poem that you like, for instance. Mm. And that I can play that back to back sometimes. I'm banging on dreadfully. I hope this isn't going to lose you.
No. You're a great writer. And I'm always, somebody who occasionally has a go with a pen, always fascinated by the sort of norms and styles.
Yeah.
What is it about cricket, do you think, that's produced great writing? I mean, it's not as though you look at ice hockey and see this sort of rich and deep philosophical literature, or the sort of the almost battle-like depictions of great games. But there's so much good writing in cricket.
There is.
Why is that?
There is. I think there's two things. I gave a speech recently, actually, Ian Chappell relaunched a second edition of my book. And I actually said, I'm a bit of a jingoist about cricket. I adore the game. But I don't think even its greatest critic would dispute that it's produced a richer load of writing than any other sport. Mm. Paradoxically, despite its brutality, boxing has produced some very fine writing. Norman Mailer wrote some really good boxing stuff. There have been some good writers about the fight game with its primal contact of man versus man, which I think goes right back to the ancients. You know, you're looking back there into Thucydides and, you know, beyond into the Peloponnesian Wars, that kind of grotesque violence. Cricket, I think it's no coincidence that cricket came from the same place as Shakespeare. It has produced some divine prose. England produces these cricketers who often turn into good writers. Ed Smith is one, and you'd probably see him in the New Statesman. Ed played 5 tests, was captain of Kent and Middlesex. Mike Selvey's a great writer at The Guardian. Victor Marks, they're really interesting. They didn't play 100 tests. They play a handful of tests and become great writers. Two things about that. Most of them are products of the English public school system. Whatever your class resentments or sense of entitlement about that, you go to Eton or Winchester or Harrow, you're probably going to read Latin, you're probably going to get a good dose of Shakespeare. So a lot of them have beautiful pens, those guys, and they're public school boys. But cricket, the other thing about cricket, I think, is the long interrogation of a five-day match where nature impacts on the game. The fact that it has this subtlety and can be gentle and rhythmic in times, and it's played amid beautiful summer settings. All these aesthetics, I think, evoke great writing. And the other thing that I think might explain it, is that it actually is primitive in one sense. Despite all the subtleties now, and you've got ball tracking and you've got DRS and you've got all these other things, when Mitchell Johnson was rampaging through England in 2013-14, a good mate of mine, Derek Pringle, again, another England test player, now writes for the press. And Pring said an interesting thing to me that had been lost on me. He said, this isn't a team game. He said, this is 11-on-1 when you're batting. And when you've got a guy like Johnson throwing a projectile at a man in armour with a club, he said, you've got the Battle of Thermopylae. And if you wonder where that comes from, well, that's what inspired some of the great ancient, the ancients, wrote of not the Punic Wars, but the Athenian Wars, gave us Thucydides and the Melian dialogues and so on. So I think it's got a bit of everything. It's got beauty, it's got poetry, it comes from England, from which so much wonderful prose came. And there's that hint of absolutely primal combat in it I think is an underestimated element of that.
Or at the other end, just the metaphors that seem to come at it. I took a course at Sydney University Law School called Cricket and the Law.
Really?
For which the key text was titled The Man in White is Always Right.
Wow.
And chapter by chapter explored the parallels between cricket and the development of the law.
I'm not familiar with that title. I must get it.
It's not a bad book. But what about, do you have a favourite piece of cricket writing?
Yeah, there are two. Ed Smith wrote the definitive tribute to Rahul Dravid when he retired, when he called him a vintage champion of timeless steel and dignity, because there's an element of Dravid that links back to the great technicians of the 1930s with that the meticulous footwork, the high baroque backlift. And he's also the greatest gentleman ever to play cricket. He's a beautiful, beautiful human being. You spend a minute with Rahul Dravid and you know you're in the presence of a Hindu mystic. He's beautiful. But a piece, we had a bit of a natter. I read a piece by a friend of mine, Shild Berry, and Shild edited Wisden for a few years, and they don't let Muppets do that. So Shild's got a pretty darn good pen. He's the VVS Lakshman of the scribblers. He wrote a piece that I so envied last year. England were touring South Africa, and in the middle of the summer, after all that nation has lived through, forged on the anvil of racial hatred with the most discriminatory policy under apartheid, the only thing that springs to mind, leave aside the Holocaust, which is, once you start invoking the Holocaust, you've lost the argument, as they say, but to have had apartheid with that second-class citizenship based on colour, only slavery in the American South rivals it. And yet, in January 2016, there was a debate inspired by Twitter that black Africans should not be allowed on the beaches of South Africa after all that nation has lived through, after Mandela has been released from jail and died, and that beautiful anthem that they've composed with the Afrikaans and the Xhosa and English all merged into one. And here we have this debate. And Shild captured the moment beautifully, just as the match captured the moment. England were playing South Africa. The colonial power is playing. You couldn't have scripted this. If you'd thrown this up to a Hollywood director, they'd have thrown the script back in your face. Hashim Amla came out to bat, the first non-white captain of South Africa. In his previous 16 test matches, he hadn't passed 50. He couldn't buy a run. He was struggling for his place in the team. He walks into this cauldron of public debate about race in South Africa, an observant Muslim man. He got 201. He came in on Sunday afternoon. He departed just after lunch on Tuesday. And as Schild observed, as he walked off, he would have seen young white South African boys wearing Muslim beards on their faces. And there were vendors selling these improvised beards in the crowd.
Wonderful.
Just beautiful. The social acceptance. These kids have gone, Hashim's our guy. That has done more than any attempt to regulate or to coerce people into saying multiculturalism is good. His bat has been his wand. His bat has been his scimitar. And then at the other end, a young man called Temba Bavuma from a township, Lungar, outside Cape Town. Admittedly, he won a scholarship and had a decent education later on, but he came from pretty humble origins. There was a debate that he was a racial quota pick, that he wasn't good enough to play for South Africa. And he's a kid, he's 23. He walks into this seething cauldron, carrying the weight of his nation's history, the weight of his people's pride. Mm. And what's he do? In a very ticklish match situation, he gets 100. A fairy tale like that. And what makes it better is the response of England, because the crowd enjoyed it. And Schild captured it beautifully. He said the entire media contingent stood in the box and applauded when he got the 100. He said, the first time in 50 years of writing that I've seen a milestone thus observed. Every England player walked over and hugged him. And the Barmy Army, who recognised an underdog, stood and sang Jerusalem. And as Schild said, and Schild with his lovely Etonian classic education said, yes, even the ranks of Tuscany could scarce forbear to cheer, quoting Macaulay's Horatius at the Bridge. It was an exquisite essay. I'll mail you the link. It just for the prose and the construct of the argument, it's a perfect piece of cricket writing. I'd have died to have written it. I'd have cut off an arm to have written that piece. And I sent him a message. I said, Schild, you've just a clip. I'll give it up. I'm not going to call myself a cricket writer after reading that.
Well, even if you do give it up, you've still got your playing, of course, because you're still a pretty serious player.
Well, I'm playing first grade locally, and Greg Chappell and Pat Howard have both been, one, terribly generous to me in supporting me. So's Alex Blackwell, and so's Aaron Osborne, the captain of our local Meteors team. I didn't... I'm 60. You've got to be realistic. There's two things about that. One is I wouldn't be playing men's first grade cricket at 60. I've got to be realistic. I've got a strong game. I've got some body strength that is bequeathed by my male gender from before. I'm seeing the ball pretty well. I've got a batting coach in Sydney, Michelle Gosco, who's a Southern Stars player, got a double ton against England. Gozzy still thinks I've got it. She's telling me to play next year. I'll play first grade in Sydney, she thinks. And I'll front up for the Breakers Challenge next year. And again, she's endorsing that. I'm a week-to-week proposition, Andrew, as you know. But you're a runner. The body gets a bit tighter each time.
Yes.
But look, I'm playing pretty well, to be honest. At the moment, I'm actually playing in the subcontinental comp here with a Pakistani men's team. And that's a story in its own right for acceptance and the joy of cricket and playing amongst a group of young Pakistani expats. Mm. Playing pretty decent cricket. My aspiration is to go to England, work on a book about the last 5 years, post-transition, what's life been like on the road, talk about some of the famous grounds I've been at, and I'm hoping I play some county cricket. The bottom half of the register, I'm told, is not terribly strong. Greg Chappell got in touch with Claire Connor from the ECB. I think I'll probably end up getting a couple of county hits, and if that's it for me, then that so be it. But I'm enjoying my cricket and still playing.
What position do you play?
I open and I bowl a bit of left-arm orthodox. And I've got to tell you, I thought my bowling was behind me, but I picked up three poles the other day. And I don't know whether it's because the batsmen were peeling with laughter and falling away from the wicket, but I clean bowled a bloke who was absolutely on fire with a rank long hop. So it just goes to show, I bowled two cracker balls that didn't do any good and bowled a bloke with a long hop. So it's a funny old game. But I open the batting. I'm batting really well. I've only been out to bowlers. I've had 11 innings and I've been run out more often than I've been out to a bowler. I got bowled once and every other time I've either been not out or run out. So I'm doing a bit right.
Sounds like it brings you a great deal of pleasure.
It does. It's a meditation. It's a joy. And again, of course, with the age factor, you never know when it's your last one. And It's a link to my past too. I walked away from the game for a long time, Andrew, and recovering it, having walked away with broken dreams a long time ago, to go back in my affirmed gender and rediscover cricket is a real gift. So I savour every moment I'm out there, frankly.
Well, you know that cycle is also possible for you in with regard to the Labor Party too.
Are you inviting me back?
Absolutely.
Well, to be continued.
The
Chief Minister's been very kind to me about that as well. I'd have to ameliorate a couple of views, but probably not too many, actually.
Let's talk off air. So to wrap up, let me ask you, what advice would you give to your teenage self?
Oh, wow. Oh, look, it's going to sound bloody terrible and cliched. Just do it. Look, I talk to some young trans kids occasionally about this, and I just think, and I say to them, what you've just told me tells me you're transgendered. It won't go away, so do it. So my advice, you know, and some of this sounds like desk calendar sort of Melody Beattie stuff, you know, those self-help books that can sometimes have a pearl of wisdom but are often ghastly. But, you know, honestly, Andrew, with depth perception, looking back on a life, my heart has invariably been right and my mind has often been wrong. And if you've got a passion, whether it's for painting or cricket or writing or whatever, then I commend to you as a teenager, and I'd say it to Catherine McGregor, Malcolm as she was, do it. And I tell kids this all the time. You know, you've got your whole life to repair mistakes, and we're a land of the second chance, and a benign universe tends to give us a second chance at redemption. I rarely think, if you're given a talent or a passion, I think your heart knows and you should follow it. I've been talking to a young kid lately, actually. He's been doing some post-school education. His heart's not really in it. He wants to play cricket. And I've helped him find a club in England, and I've helped find a person to fund his passage to England. And I said, you can sort your tertiary education out a long way down the track. I'm 60 and I'm about to embark on another degree after a long time. You know, it's never too late, mate, but your heart's telling you this. Listen to it. And so I'd say that to me too. I'd say, listen to your heart. Not easy to do when you're young because you're getting so many messages about achievement. We all desperately want to please parents. We have all kinds of arbitrary benchmarks that we think we need to meet. And I think we often block ourselves by being very rational, and often great truth lies in the irrational.
What's something you used to believe but no longer do?
Gee. Let me think. Well, I'll be really frank on a couple of things. One is I genuinely grew up in regional Queensland, and I had a lot of stereotypical views about Aborigines, Indigenous people. I don't. I've got, you know, I outgrew that. I was cultured to believe that Indigenous people didn't want to work, that they were society's burden. I carried that for a long time. We grew up second nature, and you'd know this. In terms of racial friction in Australia, it's people with the greatest proximity to Indigenous Australians experience the most stereotypical attitudes. You know, people who live in the inner city and have more enlightened views often don't have proximity to Indigenous communities. Mm. I served with a lot of Indigenous soldiers, and it broke my prejudices down completely. I had three Indigenous guys and a Thursday Islander in my first platoon. I adored those men. I had two instructors at Duntroon, one of whom I'm still in touch with, who was one of the finest Australians I ever knew. That punctured that completely for me. I grew up with that as a really subconscious bias. Something else I didn't believe. A political belief. I don't believe government can solve all problems. I was a Kennedy Democrat growing up. Bobby Kennedy was my hero. JFK was my hero. I literally, when I was in my 20s and 30s, thought nationalisation worked, tax the rich to hell, do it all, sort everything out. I don't believe that anymore. I believe we've got to be very subtle. We've got to be very targeted about how we spend public money. I've reluctantly come to the conclusion that long-term deficit budgeting doesn't work. I didn't believe that Bob Carr will tell you, we used to have blazing rows. I was an absolute Peronista in terms of economic views way back. I was a complete Luddite. When the Keating Revolution was on in the Labor Party, I was in the right-wing faction, but sentimentally was in the left. So my economic views have changed a bit, but I'm certainly not a complete liberal in that sense. I think there is a role for government to raise living standards and to enable people to reach their potential. Yeah.
When are you most happy?
When I'm batting and I'm not out and I'm at the non-striker's end. No, that's not quite true. When am I happy? Music, writing sometimes, reading always. I'm happy very much with Tricia. When we're just, we can do really goofy stuff and watch Netflix, binge watch stuff on telly. I've got a handful of very close friends. I enjoy talking to them. I like solitude. A lot of people think I'm an extrovert because I've got the gift of the gab. I'm actually quite a private person. I can have long periods alone where I just read and listen to music and sing aloud and not be fussed whether I'm in tune or not. That my spirit leaps at that. Mm. But I do, yeah, look, if you ask me when I'd like my, you know, I'd love to die in the media box at Lord's an hour into the first session of an Ashes test match on a June day with perfect, that sky like upturned porcelain that you get at the height of the English summer and just gently drift off next to my computer. That might be bliss.
What's the most important thing you do to stay mentally and physically healthy?
I exercise. I think that's important. I do find that I'm prone to depression. I suffer from depression and anxiety. I've been treated for them at numerous times in my life. Transitioning genders has abated that a lot. It's extraordinary. And again, the scorners and the trolls and the others rant on about transgendered women. The introduction of estrogen into a genetic male who is trans has a palliative effect. That has calmed me enormously. I like training. I'm reasonably careful about what I eat. I don't eat any junk food. So exercise is great for well-being. I meditate and I pray. And again, I think that shocks a lot of people. I've been vilified a lot by very, very strict Catholics. Most mainstream Catholics are quite fine. They're not. Plenty don't understand my gender transition, and not many endorse it as such, but very few are militant about it. But there is a sect within Catholicism, and it's not Opus Dei, it's the Society of Pius X, I think they call themselves, who are virulently transphobic. But I pray and meditate. I try not to leave the house without playing some guided meditations. I do some breathing. I read some spiritual literature, and I use a form of prayer and meditation and stillness. And, it, you know, what is it? Mens sana in corpore sano. I try to just keep myself a bit healthy, and I try to get some privacy and some periods of stillness to just get my well-being in place. And they're the main things. And don't exercise nearly enough. You're a fitness person, I know, and it shows. I try to get to the gym, but I would much prefer to get there more regularly than I'm doing. And when you're travelling a lot, that can be a challenge, as you know.
Yes. Yeah, I find paradoxically it's easier to fit in exercise every day than three times a week. Because if you're doing three times a week, there's always the, oh, I won't do it today, I'll do it tomorrow excuse.
I completely get that. And I think you're blessed you're still running. I've got no specific prohibitions on running now, but I've not done regular running since about 2015. No injuries, but I'm just trying to lighten the load on my knees. So I'll do hill sprints to try to get the aerobic effect rapidly. Like I'll do, say, 10 or 15 100s up a slope, and the rest is strength and conditioning and stretching, and I just try to keep myself mobile.
Yes, this research on high intensity training is really interesting, and even just fast up a couple of sets of stairs apparently has a decent effect.
Well, you do notice it, because I got into a state where I was reasonably fit. I don't know whether you saw that episode of Australian Story that they did with me. They didn't bodgy that scene. I used to run up Ainslie not that long ago,
and they couldn't get the camera angle right. So I'm actually chasing that darn truck several times and wouldn't have blown a candle out at the end. I was quite running fit at that time. But you can, as you know, get to a point where you're lobbing along at a reasonable clip but not getting aerobically exhausted, whereas you race up a couple of flights of stairs and you're sucking it in more than a 4 or 5 kilometre run if you're not doing it the right way. And that alerted me to that, I must say.
Do you have any guilty pleasures?
Goodness. No, I'm pretty boring, actually. Probably the only... You know, double shot coffees are a weakness. I drink too much coffee. When my friend Tom at Idelic offers me the third double shot in the morning while I'm reading the papers, and I invariably say yes, we go through this ritual as though I'm ever going to say no, and I have a third. That's not very nice. I don't eat chocolate anymore. I gave that up. Guilty pleasures, watching. I watch some not highly elevating television, you know, the good crime dramas. I read Rebus novels occasionally. I read a bit of crime. Peter Corris has just done his last one. None of that is ever going to win an award at Oxford, but I can plough through a crime novel and get a guilty fix out of that.
And finally, what person or what experience has most shaped your view of living an ethical life?
Wow. Look, I admire no one more than my wife. I say that genuinely. I've been stunned at the grandeur of her personality. A person who's in the public domain, who's had a couple of people, I'm being greedy here, and not conspicuously avoiding politics either. My hero from childhood, and I still can read speeches from Robert F. Kennedy that touch me deeply, and I would love to think that I could ever have lived to that, and I haven't. Of people I know and have seen up close and whose integrity and there are three men that I know through cricket, all of whom are kind of like the still point of the turning world because they are so comfortable with who they are. They can look you in the eye and disagree vehemently with you but be civil and respectful. One's Ian Chappell, the other's his brother Greg, who still carries himself like a Coldstream guardsman on parade, that erect carriage and steely kind of visage. They've been generous to a fault to me. I admire them immensely because they're really level, they're really honest. They'll tell you bollocks when you run an idea, but they don't. It's not personal and they don't get head up about it. And the other one's Raoul Dravid. Mm. And I was exchanging emails with Raoul about the forthcoming series. And again, I bang on about him a bit and I speak about him when I do Speaking on the Road. But you've got to know him to see the depth of that man's character. He was a god to one of the poorest countries on earth. And I think when you had the recognition and the pressure that man's had, he can't go anywhere without being flocked by people who adore him. And the evenness and humility with which he conducts himself is exemplary. He's got no airs and graces. I've seen him stand under a blazing sun and sign every autograph of every Indian boy. Mm. Hundreds. And he must have wanted to just go and have a shower and have some privacy. But he believes it's his solemn duty to his country because he said a beautiful thing. He said, there were dozens of kids at my school who could have played Test cricket for India, but their parents didn't have the money to send them onto a good program. He said, I owe it to them every time I go out to bat to do India proud. And the game has given me so much so that when our bus goes through the poorest postcodes on earth and I see a man look up from backbreaking toil and smile at me, just for playing a game, I owe them everything. And there isn't a request that they make of me that I can deny.
That's fantastic. Mm. Well, writer, military officer, cricketer, Kate McGregor, thank you very much for taking the time to appear on the Good Life podcast today.
Absolute pleasure, Andrew, and what a wonderful initiative. I hope you get some more interesting people through.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this week's episode of The Good Life. If you like this podcast, please let your friends know on Facebook, Twitter, or your favourite social media app. Next week, I'll be back with Bob Carr to discuss Chekhov, Pilates, opera, and more.